My name's Phil Cordham. I'm 46 years old. It's October 3rd, 2007, and we're at the Human Factors and Ergonomics Conference in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm interviewing Camille, and she's a friend of mine.
My name's Camille Paris. I am going to be 41 years old tomorrow. Today's date is October 3rd, 2007, and we are in Baltimore at the Human Factors and Ergonomics Conference, and Phil is a friend and colleague of mine.
So, Camille, you've taken a very interesting path to becoming a human factors person. Can you just tell me a little bit about how you got where you are today?
Well, I think the shortest way of saying it is just following my heart and what was in front of me at the time. And when I was in school and wanting to finish school, and I was a psychology major at the time because I'm interested in people and how they operate, but wasn't finding the material particularly engaging, and spending a lot of my time with the theater crowd. And they desperately needed people that could organize all of the artists and that liked to play with the equipment, because a lot of the people that were I was working with just wanted to be on stage. And that was probably my first experience with realizing my affinity for technology. And when I would be in the booth and during a show, and running the soundboard was the first job that I had. And it was a children's show, so it was about 45 minutes long, and it had probably 200 sound cues. So it was really busy, and there was using all different kinds of sound equipment, and making sure that I had things set up in the right place so that I could respond quickly was, so that was in front of me. It was at the time I did stage managing for a while and really developed, like I said, my affinity for the technology. But I didn't want to work nights all the time. And so that's when I went back and was job coach. And as a job coach, for people who were going trying to get back to work after some sort of injury, these people had head injuries. I was in Galveston. And as a job coach, you have to do a lot of task analysis. You have to break down a job into very fine points depending on what the client's needs were. If they have very severe mental deficiencies, then it would have to be at the really, really fundamental level. So I started gaining an appreciation of breaking a task down so that, and then figuring out how to present it in a way that could be understandable and useful and help somebody in their lives. But I didn't, it was hard for me to work with people that were in pain and were their psychic pain, so the families and all of that. And I went back to school and discovered research, and that I really liked. I'd always been somebody who asked questions all the time. I think I was born an academic. At least that's what the teachers would tell my mother whenever she got to the parent meeting. Why does Camille ask so many questions? That they either loved that or hated it. But so when I discovered research and that whole process, and then all the technology and all the computer toys and everything that I could play with that, that was really another sort of shift in the road for me. And I love the scientific method. I love systematically finding out the answers to these questions and really just being limited by my ability to be clever with how to ask the question and how to go about answering it. And so I finished a master's program. It's very general, just really kind of how do you do research in social psych, and started working with some large research bodies at the University of Houston, research groups, and was teaching and doing research projects in my spare time. And my full-time job was in institutional effectiveness, which is basically just a giant data management program for universities. And became more familiar with more toys, and then started being the source of information. Our office was the source of information about how do you use this website so that you can get this information in. How can I present these things in a way that the data become information? That was really the mantra, is turning these data into information. And that's, of course, all about usability. That's all about user-centered design. And so when I was looking to apply to PhD programs I was geographically bound. I was going to be staying in Houston and because of my family, and saw that at Rice there was this program called Human-Computer Interaction and / Human Factors. I'd never heard of either one of those before, and emailed the advisor and David Lane and gave him a couple of paragraphs about who I am and my background and my interests, and was wondering if I could visit to find out if it might be a match. And he said, "Can you come on Thursday?" And I showed up on Thursday, and so I think for me then that was it has been the culmination of all these other different paths. I've used a lot of skills that I know from theater, remarkably, although I think that that's it's just lately that I've become aware of how much of that that skill set that I use. But all of the different places and spaces I've been were wonderful, and I was passionate and interested in them, but they never felt like a culmination for me until I found the human factors and being able to help people and have it be about people, but getting to play with all my techie toys and then getting to ask questions and be clever about how I answer them, and it's everything all together. So for me, it's been it's a really wonderful thing that I've discovered. And I don't know that if I had seen it before, if it would have been as obvious to me that that's where I wanted to go. Maybe I needed to take that.
So is it just? It sounds like it was sort of a gentle slide into the profession. Did you have an aha moment where you said, "Oh my gosh, this is exactly what I want to do"?
Did I have an aha moment? Probably in that conversation with David, where we went and he started talking about what kind of research that he does and is done in the field, and that, and then I was just so excited about the idea of applying to school at Rice. That was pretty exciting in and of itself. But I think probably it was an awakening more than an epiphany that probably about the middle of the fall semester, that very first fall semester that I was there, that I just thought, I can't believe this. I can't believe this is really as cool, that this is really as good a fit as this it is. So, that first semester I was completely sold. Yeah.
So what makes you get up every morning and continue to do it?
I think it's the questions that sort of the questions compel me to, I want to find out what the answer is. And now that I'm teaching, I'm in a faculty position, and I find myself being compelled now by what does the profession need for me to teach these students? How am I going to give them the beginnings? Because I'm not going to give them all of their skill set, but how am I going to give them the beginnings of a skill set that's going to make a difference in how the crew exploration vehicle is designed, or how one student in my class is actually has a company that builds websites. How am I going to give him the skills he needs to be able to do that better? That's a real challenge. So it's the finding out those answers is that's what gets me up every day. Depending on what environment I'm in, if it's my research, my particular scientific endeavor I'm doing, or the answers to what my students need.
So you're doing a lot of work in sound design right now. Is that where you see your future research going, or do you see some new opportunities that you just want to pursue?
I think I'm trying to be a little more disciplined with where I go, what I pursue. I could have probably 5 different research lines going on at any given time. Right now, I think the auditory displays as well as the efficiency work, those are my 2 main lines of research, and I want to see those through. I want to get it, not through because there's not going to be a completion, but I want to get to a maturity with those 2 areas so that I can make an impact and really start giving information and impacting the design fields in both of those areas. I'd like to be able to communicate the question, the answers to the question to the people who need it, And so I'm going to focus just on two, at least for the next couple of 3 years, and then we'll see. I might get distracted again, but that's my goal right now.
So in 20 years, when you look back, what's something that you'd like to be able to say, this is what I did, this is what I contributed to society or academics?
Well, I'd like to be able to look back in 20 years. Okay, so I'd be 60. I'd like to be able to look back and know that I impacted people's lives personally, professionally, and that I helped somehow. I'd like to be able to have seen in 20 years a clearer path developed for translating the science that we have to practice. And I'd like to be a part of that. I'd like to know that I played a part in developing those communication mechanisms. And I guess that's what I'd like to, personally, I'd like to, know that my children are happy and that life is good and feel, what is it that you want to be able to look back on your life and, smile about it. And I'd certainly live each day trying to do that as well.
Do you think you're going to be in academics for the rest of your life?
Oh, yeah. I'll always be in academics. I always have been. It just wasn't official. I didn't know it. I didn't realize it. There's a funny story behind that. I don't know if I've told you this story, that when I had gone back to school for my first master's degree and was taking the statistics class that I had successfully avoided as an undergraduate, which, of course, as you know, is quite ironic given that I teach it now and I love it, and I'm just such a quantitative geek. But so I'm speaking with this woman who's my professor, and she said, well, Camille, what do you think you want to do? Well, I don't know. It was my answer. But I know I don't want to do research and I don't want to teach. And she smiled and nodded and said, okay. And it was, evidently it was pretty clear to anybody else who was looking that that is exactly what I was going to do. So the naiveties of a 20-something-year-old, Yeah. So, I will be in academia. I think that's where I am the most comfortable. People tolerate me the best there.
Probably a good place for you.
Exactly.
So have you had anybody in your life that you might pick out as being particularly influential?
It's hard. I couldn't pick out one. That would be really tough to do. I think, is everybody's life. My parents, obviously, and just the strength that my mother has given me, and then the perspectives from my father. My dad's a vocational rehab consultant, and I grew up hearing the phrase, Camille, there are too many jobs out there in the world for anybody to do one that they don't like. And so that was always resonated with me, and I think that gave me the freedom to continue pursuing something until I was passionate about it, like he is about his work. And but there's so many, the brave people who pulled me aside and said, do you really think this is where you want to be, or have you thought about this? And one guy I worked for a few years, and he knew that I wanted to eventually go on to a PhD program, and I came in and was just kind of teasing him because we called each other by first name. But I came in one day and said, well, Dr. Underwood, some blah, 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 whatever it was. And he looked up at me and said, well, Dr. DeBee Paris. And it stopped me in my tracks. It took my breath away, and because he was clearly communicating, one, just to hear it, and then two, how powerfully he was communicating his belief that I was going to do that. So there's lots of people that some of them have been moments of just kind of confidence that made a big impact on me. And then there's other people that on a more regular basis have really guided me, supported me, directed me. So directed, not many people direct me, actually.
Nobody directs
me. I know. Much to my husband's chagrin. That's the reason I was never on stage in theater. I was always backstage.
Got to push the buttons.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're starting this really wonderful program at UHCL, And can you just tell us a little bit about it? Because when I watch you, you're unbelievably passionate about getting this going. And every time we talk, it's all I can do to, like, keep you in one spot as you talk about it. Can you just sort of tell me a little bit about your motivation and why this is such an important thing for you?
Well, that's a good question. You're right. I am really passionate about that right now. And there's a couple of levels of that passion. One of them is that it seems silly to me that they're right by NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston, where there's a growing medical community there. I mean, literally in that small area, there's such a need for people with our knowledge base, with the human factors, ergonomics, biomechanics knowledge base. And there's a university there that isn't officially yet, you know, training people on how to do that. And university with the science and engineering school and a human sciences school. So there was just a clear gap in deliverables in a situation that can use it. And then it's just a matter of getting to talk to all these great people. I've lived in the area long enough that I know a bunch of people down there. And so getting to sort of play matchmaker in a way, and kind of how are we going to pull together all of these resources and meet this need. But the other side of that is, you know, I keep hearing about reading that we don't have enough people in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, so the STEM fields, and that women in particular and minorities as well are not represented in this group. And it strikes me that, like myself, I didn't want to do engineering for the sake of it. That was not compelling to me. I was an engineering major when I was a freshman in college at the University of Texas. And it wasn't enough to keep me going, even though I have an engineer's mind. But it was the human side of it that was very compelling for me. And I think that for underrepresented groups, this is a wonderful way of getting into STEM. And so if you have STEM fields, and if there's a generation of people that we can expose this to, then their children are going to be exposed to more science, the STEM fields. And I think that that can be a way of disseminating sort of the joys for those people that it fits of this field, and that it's not all wearing a lab coat and dealing with nanotubes and all of that sort of stuff. And there's people that need mentorship. They need it from, you know, first-generation college students. And I'm uniquely placed at U of H Clear Lake. We have a non-traditional student body there, and average age is 35. Lots of people working full-time, lots of people with children, lots of single mothers. So this is, I think, a place where I could make a systematic difference. And I'm, you know, I hear that the community needs it. So, and there's so many jobs out there. I mean, there's more jobs out there than there are people. So here, you're absolutely, I'm just going, da-da-da-da-da. But there's more jobs out there than there are people to fill them. And so there's a lot of needs to meet. And I feel, I'm excited about this place and space that I'm in right now, that I might really be able to make it something special.
So do you see your students grasping onto that? I mean, so many times when you teach, there's sort of this segment of class that is just there to get through the class. Do you see yourself making this change in these kids?
Yeah. Oh, they're not kids, though. These are grown-ups. But, the average age in my classroom is right now probably 40.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, these are grown-ups, absolutely. And now the statistics classes I teach in the research class, that's a required class, and they really don't care about, for the most part. Some of them become eventually engaged. One or two. Some is not nearly enough. But the class I'm teaching of the people that have decided to come, so this user-centered design class is one that I'm teaching right now. They are really at that sort of awakening about, I had no idea, you know, I've always loved to play on the computer, I've always loved to build things, or I had no idea I could incorporate my interest in psychology into that as well. And asking lots of questions and leaning forward in class and really engaged in the material. And so when you come across, as you and I both know, when you come across a fit, people are just so thrilled to be able to marry these worlds. Yeah, I definitely see that.
human factors is such a weird profession. There are very few people who come to it in the beginning.
Yeah, exactly, right? From the beginning.
I mean, I know a lot of electrical engineers and physicists and mechanical engineers who are, I'm 12, I'm going to be an electrical engineer.
Yeah.
And they just go straight through. But for most human factors people, it seems that they sort of stumble onto it. Are your students coming to the program because they know they want to do HF, or it's an elective and they take it and then you energize them?
Basically what's happening is they hear about me somehow or another, and then they end up in my office and I say, well, you know, this is what I do and this is what I'm starting and this is this class, that people don't accidentally, there's one woman in the class that just needed an elective. This is the only time slot that worked. And so she's there. And I was a little worried because I said, you know, this is what this is. This may not be interesting for you. And she is as engaged or more. And so she just has lucked out on this elective. But everybody else knew what they were getting into when they got into the class. They knew me. And so that's why they came. So at least my advertising is working. I advertised enough to fill a class. Well, I think your path is interesting, too. I think it would be fun to share your path about how you got into it, because you started more from the engineering side, right?
I did start in the engineering side. I was an industrial engineer. I started out as a mechanical engineer and didn't really like the mechanical engineering piece of it. And so
that's a problem.
Yeah, it's a problem. And so I switched over to industrial engineering, and industrial engineering, you know, a lot of human factors programs live there. But even then, I didn't know that's what I wanted to do. I knew that industrial engineering was closer to what I wanted to do, because you had to think about problems in sort of a different way. It wasn't, you know, design the steam generator for this. It was, we're going to build this, and we have to think about how we would do that. And for the most part, that involves people. And uh-huh. So I still hadn't made the connection that was the piece that I was interested in, was the people part. It wasn't until, again, it was just an elective. I took a human factors course and found myself riveted by the stories that my professor would tell, and started to come to the realization that I really wasn't interested in the mechanics, but I was interested in the human side of it. And so every problem that I approached was from the side of how does the human fit into the equation. And so when I was getting my master's, I drove all my professors crazy because, you know, in every graduate class you have to do some kind of research paper. And so I could take any subject and figure out where the human piece was. So we had to do I was in a linear optimization class where you learn to do the mathematics of operations research. And I wrote a paper on how you do linear programming to do on this people task for assignment of where you put knobs and dials. And my professor was just shaking his head. He said, you know, everyone else here is doing something mainstream, very important in operations research, and you just continue to talk about these human things.
These stupid people.
And so I sort of had gradually come to accept that it was more about the human side. And so when I got the job in the defense industry, I got a job as an industrial engineer, of course. And even there, I drove my bosses crazy because it was, I got less interested in the manufacturing process than I did about the people who were doing it. And I had my big aha moment while I was at Raytheon when we were trying to build this circuit board called the Widowmaker. That was called the Widowmaker because everybody who made it died. That was the deal. It was so hard to build. And so the mechanical engineers and the electrical engineers were just saying, we don't understand why you just can't build this. It's really simple. And it wasn't simple. It was this giant circuit board. It had 8,000 pieces on it, and they were all convoluted, and it had a million jumper wires because it had been modified over the years. And they just didn't understand. I mean, their idea of how to make it better was to reprimand people who built it wrong.
Behavior management.
Yes, and these were really dedicated people building it, but it was impossible to build in its current form. And so we spent a lot of time figuring out how can I take what people know and what people's perceptions and cognition capabilities are and help them build this little thing. And so it was at that point that I decided I had to go back and get my PhD because I didn't know enough to be as effective as I thought I needed to be. And so I sort of left the whole engineering piece behind, although just kind of. When I went back, I got my PhD in bioengineering. I just couldn't let go of the engineering piece. Mm-hmm. But my major advisor was a psychologist. And so...
The best of both worlds, in that sense.
Kind of the best of both worlds. And he was one of the most mathematically oriented people I'd ever known, more so than any engineers I'd met. And so it was kind of a good fit. But it made me realize that what I really wanted to do was figure out how I could focus entirely on the user. Mm-hmm. And that the technology was just a tool. And that was the problem that I was trying to get people to solve.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Tell about your experience with the DSL. I love that story.
So it's one of the best projects I think I've ever worked on. DSL is a communications technology. Everybody knows about it now, I guess. But back then it was relatively new. It was a way to get high-speed internet. And the way it was being provisioned was that the telephone company would roll a truck out to your house and have to install it for you. And at the time, they were thinking that, you know, we'd have a few hundred DSL people install every month because it was new technology and, you know, sort of the model of who needs high-speed internet, right?
Just of course, a few. Now we can't live without
That's
it.
That's right, just a few people. And so we started talking to the technologists, and they said, well, right at that point, I think we had 97% truck rolls, and then we had 3% of the people who'd say, just send me the kit. And these were like, you know, PhD electrical engineers who said, I'll do it. And we said, well, we should try and create a self-install kit. We should have our customers do it themselves because eventually everyone's going to want DSL. And we can't send out, you know, a million trucks. And so over the course of 5 years, we worked on this kit over many, many, many iterations. We brought all these people into the lab and had them do the self-installation, and we went out in the field and watched people do it. We rode on trucks and watched technicians talk to people who were trying to do installs or who had tried to do installs. We watched the technicians do it. And so over the course of this 5 years, we built this huge knowledge base of how you would take a really complex technology and help people who really didn't have any clue about how it all worked, mm-hmm. Make it work. And, of course, now people look at the self-install kit, and this is one of the biggest compliments I get, is my folks did a self-install, and they said, that's all you do?
That's all you do? What's the big deal?
And so at that point, I knew that we had really, really been successful, because we'd taken this kit that, when the very first kit went out, they just took all the components and all the CDs and all the manuals and just put them in a box. And so it went out with 600 pages of installation instructions. And they were all conflicting, right? We had four of them that said, do me first. And the CDs said, you know, whatever you do, don't put this CD in before you put this one in. The other one would say, whatever you do, don't put this CD in before you do this one. And so we had, you know.
The drink me, eat me, yeah. Alice in Wonderland kind of, I'm going to get bigger, smaller, what's going to happen?
So we had, you know, 100% failure rates in the field. And at the end, by the time I left AT&T, we were doing 95% self-installs. And those were 98% successful. And so it was, I think it's sort of the bane of human factors. I have a slide that says, the conundrum of human factors is that good human factors is invisible.
Yes.
And so long as everything works and everything is, and there aren't any issues, people think that what you do is stupid, right? Because they're like, well, of course you design it that way. That's just the way it works.
Yeah. How obvious.
How obvious. And It's just all common sense. And it's not until you get a failure that people go, oh my God, why couldn't we, why didn't you think of that?
Yeah.
And so when the self-install kit hit the level where the upper division managers were saying, well, you know, we could hire a monkey to do this because this is how it should be, that's when I knew we really had stumbled on something great.
That's awesome. You know, and it's funny, that's one of the things I enjoy the most about teaching about human factors, whether it's not even in a classroom, but just sort of to people, to empower them to realize that if something's not working well, it's not because of your inability to do it. It's bad design.
Yes.
If it's not easy to use and you are the consumer, it was built for you, you paid for it, and you are struggling, then it's been designed badly. It's
right.
Not an incompetence on your part. And I remember that when I made that shift, just personally, when I started looking at things as not, feeling like my own frustration or frustration with myself, when I started saying, oh, this is horribly designed. Why did, you know, this is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. And when I can help people make that transition too. So I think it's when we inform people of that and we get better about letting people know if it's broken.
Right.
This is the profession that can help fix it.
Right.
And that people will then understand the difference. At least that's my little hope, that we can communicate that.
One of the exercises I give my students is in my human factors classes, I send them out and they have to find an item that has some kind of human factors deficiency, and then they have to bring it in and we talk about it. And they have to talk about it in human factors terms. I can't just say this, it's hard to use. They have to tell me why. And after I taught human factors for the first time, I got the sweetest note from one of my students that said, it started out, it said, "Dear Dr. Cordham, I hate you." And I'm like, uh-oh, this can't be good. This is my first review. And he said, "I used to really enjoy walking around the world in everyday life." He said, "Now I can't do it without seeing all the human factors deficiencies in everything I touch." He said, "Thanks." And so it was one of the nicest notes, because it made me realize that I'd actually made someone aware of sort of the totality of what human factors people do, and how the constructed world is not very well designed.
Mm-hmm.
And that he was actually thinking about it. It wasn't, he just endured my class and then left. All the lessons that we talked about had sort of stuck with him. And he was thinking about human factors on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that was really, really great.
Well, and that's one of the things I think about the goals of, you know, what would I like to in 20 years be able to look back and see. And I think individually it's hard to imagine having a big impact, but collectively I really would love for us to get to a point where good design and things that human experience and interface with all of the things that we're working with on a daily basis be easier, that I don't have, you know, five different machines. Every time I go to a grocery store, I've got a different type of machine that I'm sliding my card through, and that has a different series of steps, and that, you know, manufacturers start realizing that these little moments that you have on a daily basis, you have a million of them in a week, that I would love for us to collectively really be able to change the paradigm about that.
That's so hard, though.
It is.
I mean, you know that I carry that camera around and I take pictures of deficient items, and it never fails to amaze me. I'm always carrying the camera. I mean, it drives everyone I'm with crazy. Wait. This is really stupid design. I have to take a picture. And so every time I do that, people are like, what is this guy doing? But there's so many examples.
It's so easy.
It's just so easy. It's not like, you know, I have to struggle to find these things. The fact that I can send my students out, I can send my class of 30 people out and get new, fresh examples every time I teach the class.
Oh, wow, that's true.
Says that we're not even close.
We're getting closer, though. But, of course, I'm the optimist here, and you were the pessimist, so that's good that we've got everybody.
That's right. Yeah, 20 years of running into the brick wall, you sort of go, maybe the problem's harder than I first imagined.
But you have to make sure that you notice that the wall actually moved.
That's right.
It's still there, but it is, in fact, moving.
It is moving.
Because it's not going, to break it down.
So. No.
Yeah, so there we have our the work cut out for us for human factors. But the good news is there's always be interesting questions. There'll always be good problems to work on. And there's so and such great colleagues. I think that's one of the things I like about this world is people come from such a mixture of backgrounds. It's just a fun group of people to be around.
Absolutely.
And to work with and all the different collaborations that you can be involved in.
Well, certainly the collaborations that you and I have established
mm-hmm.
are, I never would have imagined I'd work with a hardcore psychologist on these kinds of issues. And so, or a musician.
Or a musician.
Yes.
That's been fun. That has been really fun, learning how to translate from the world of computer music composition to our world. I use examples from that collaboration in class all the time when I'm talking about learning how to talk each other's talk. Even within each other, we
right.
have to learn each other's vernacular if we're going to be successful.
Right. So just to wrap up the interview, do you think, given your advanced age, what do you think your retirement plans are going to be?
Oh, I'm not going to retire.
Not going to retire?
I know that. I won't retire. That's the beauty of academia. You know, I'll be professor emeritus, hopefully, somewhere and teach when I want to and do whatever research I want to do and play and be involved in, you know, professional organizations like HFES and still be involved. And retiring doesn't sound particularly appealing to me. So there's not things that I want to do that I'm not able to do because of my work. So, I know. I'll be doing this for a long time.
That's great.
Well, and I want to say, too, I appreciate you doing this with me. I think it's been fun.
Well, you know me.
Yeah, exactly. I'm shocked you're here.
I couldn't resist. I knew that all I had to do was ask one question and that you would do the rest of the work.